This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, August 22, 2002. I'm Deepa Fernandez. President Bush proposes more logging to stop bushfires currently sweeping the Northwest. Tractors, cows and black farmers march on Washington protesting the loan discrimination they continue to face. And with the UN Summit on Sustainable Development kicking off this weekend, we look at one of the major issues, privatizing water. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The indigenous people of a town in El Salvador are under siege by officials who say the people may have the legal title to the land, but they do not have the right to live there. Jenka Soderberg explains.
Salvadoran police have surrounded and are threatening to attack a village of indigenous Maya, Lenca, and Nahuatl people in San Ramon, Sonsonate, El Salvador. San Ramon is the spiritual and ceremonial center for more than 4,000 indigenous families in El Salvador. Adrián Esquinolito, their spiritual leader.
When the police come into our community, everyone gets scared because they remember what happened in the community of Las Hojas in 1982, when 74 of our people were killed by the military police.
Since the massacre in 1982, more than 75% of the indigenous people's land base has been illegally taken from them by government and private interests. The Supreme Court of El Salvador, headed by a friend of the general who ordered the 1982 massacre, has ruled that even though the indigenous people hold legal title, they have no rights to the land. The police have said that at 9 a.m. tomorrow, Friday, August 23rd, they will forcibly remove the 200 residents of San Ramon, Sonsonate. Jenka Soderberg for Free Speech Radio News.
The U.S. Justice Department has filed suit to seize tens of millions of dollars from former Enron executives. Jay Tamboli reports from D.C.
The Justice Department is also moving to recover money from other Enron executives, in addition to Fasto, who was the chief financial officer, including former lawyer Christina Mordaunt. The suits are largely based on information provided by Michael Copper, former managing director at Enron, who yesterday pleaded guilty to charges related to his role. Copper agreed to pay $12 million, and that money, along with $14 million from Fasto, will be returned to investors who lost money when Enron collapsed, although no mention was made of payments to former employees who lost retirement savings. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., this is Jay Tamboli.
Today, tenured professor Sami Al-Arian said he would fight back against the university that's trying to fire him for his alleged ties to terrorism. Mitch Perry reports from Tampa.
The University of South Florida announced last December they would fire Al-Arian after his controversial appearance on Fox News, where his past alleged associations with terrorism were brought forth. At that time, the school said it was because he violated his collective bargaining agreement. But yesterday, the school added the allegations of terrorism to their case. Al-Arian said today he would not back down from fighting for his job.
My case right now is not really about me anymore. It's about the principal, and I think I'll be betraying the principal if I just walk out. A lot of people are writing. They don't want to set a precedent where an administration can simply fire a tenured professor because of his political views.
Al-Arian has never been charged with any crime. Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
Two U.S. citizens have launched a nationwide campaign to support the United Nations Population Fund as a way to counter the Bush administration's withholding of $34 million from the U.N. agency. Heather Risby reports from the U.N.
Two independent grassroots campaigners have started sending emails to 34 million people urging each to donate a dollar or more to the United Nations Population Fund. The UNFPA officials said today they have already started receiving checks from individual citizens from all over the United States. The two American campaigners, Lois Abraham of New Mexico and Jane Roberts of Redford, California, said in a statement, "At a time when America is looking for cooperation from the world, the Bush administration has shut the doors on women in poor countries who need help to plan their families and give birth safely." For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Risby at the United Nations.
Finally, parents in Marianna, Arkansas, are refusing to send their children to school for a fourth day in a row as part of a boycott against what they consider an unfair school board election. According to organizers, the 2000 census would require all 7 school board seats to be up for grabs. However, board members say only 2 seats will be contested in next month's elections. Mariana ranks as one of the poorest communities, 108th of 110, in one of the nation's poorest states. 4 religious leaders filed suit against the Lee County School District, the superintendent, the school board, and local elections officials for violating the state constitution's election provisions. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
President Bush is expected to propose making it easier for the timber industry to thin national forests. An administration official says the president will announce the plan on his trip to the West Coast that began today. Advocates of thinning say it will help reduce catastrophic fires like the ones sweeping western states this summer. But not everyone agrees that commercial logging can help reduce fire danger at all. From Rapid City, South Dakota, Joshua Welsh reports.
The Black Hills National Forest, like much of the West this summer, has seen countless acres of timber go up in smoke. Even this week, a wildfire has consumed more than 10,000 acres and come within 2 miles of Mount Rushmore, the granite monument which served as a backdrop for President Bush's visit to the state just one day before the fire started. During his speech, Bush said the nation needs common sense forest policy for the good of the economy.
We must keep them disease-free. We must have reasonable forest policies so as to prevent fires, not encourage them.
The details of the Bush plan won't be released until later today, but it's expected the president will try to relax administrative barriers to cutting timber from national forests while making it harder for environmental groups and others to appeal logging plans. Tom Troxell is the director of the Black Hills Forest Resource Association, a local timber industry group. He says making it easier to log in the forest would benefit forest health and reduce fire danger.
When you look at the fire season that we've had across the West this year, I think what a lot of people have seen is a overwhelming public recognition that there are some problems in the national forest, and the fires we've seen this year are a symptom of those problems.
But many environmentalists disagree. Jeff Kessler is the conservation director for Wyoming-based Biodiversity Conservation Alliance, a group which has worked to stop logging in parts of the Black Hills National Forest. Kessler says what he's seen of the Bush plan is a Trojan horse meant to confuse controlling wildfires with effectively protecting lives and property.
In general, doing things miles from actual places you're trying to protect is fruitless.
Kessler says to really protect a home in the woods, the forest within a few dozen yards of that home is what needs to be managed. He says that wildfires are part of the forest and that people won't be able to stop them from burning. But Kessler says the president's plan won't do anything to make structures and homes in the forest more fire safe. He also says the plan worries him because it seeks to change the role of public participation in national forest management.
Those public participation appeals, comment, processes are designed specifically to make sure that vested financial interests don't run the show. These are national forests owned in common by all citizens. They're not owned by corporations.
Kessler says the current policy debate is misleading because it talks about stopping fires, which he says can't be done and is bad for forest health, rather than informing people who live in the forest how they can protect their homes. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Joshua Welsh in Rapid City, South Dakota.
African American farmers brought tractors and livestock to Washington this morning to rally in front of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Some are winners of a 3-year court settlement the USDA still hasn't made good on. Others say they're discriminated against when seeking loans. Black farmers say they're facing extinction. The USDA is passing the buck. Joshua Chaffin has this report.
3 years ago, black farmers across the country won a class action lawsuit alleging they were denied loans because of their race. The USDA agreed to pay $50,000 in each of the cases, and the USDA says it has paid more than $600 million to black farmers and forgiven more than $17 million in loans. But almost 8,500 cases have been denied, and farmers say the checks are slow to come. John Boyd is president of the National Black Farmers Association.
They are talking about if they prevailed in a class action lawsuit, then send them the check. Get the check out in the mail and give it to them. If it's in the mail, they cut up another one. Do like any other Fortune 500 company would do. Pay people who've been victimized.
I'm Lou Gallegos. I'm Assistant Secretary for Administration, USDA. We welcome these folks into Washington, D.C., because since this administration came into office, we have had nothing less but a cordial exchange and relationship with African-American farmers and all minority farmers across this country.
That's why 3 years after the court order, they're still waiting for the check.
Listen, there may be some people waiting for the check, and there's a lot of people who have gotten a check.
Why are they waiting for a check 3 years after the court order?
Because the check is not an automatic check.
They rob all of us out of the most important thing. That's our youth.
South Carolina farmer Hezekiah Gibson stands on a trailer in front of the USDA building.
I'm 57 years old, still trying to get justice from 1984. I sat in the courtroom and Judge Freeman said, we're going to get these farmers back in the field.
That's right.
Give them their money. We ain't got no fields. We ain't got no money. I know what it is to have a crop with somebody got a lien on it that didn't give you enough money in the first place. And you got a daughter fixed to go to a prom that can't go to a prom because you ain't got the damn money to buy a dress.
Just 1% of U.S. farmers are black. They say they are an endangered species, and they want a moratorium on farm foreclosures until they get the money they say the government owes them. The USDA says it can forestall foreclosures on a case-by-case basis. According to the Farmers Rallying D.C., even after they won the class action suit, they complain it takes longer for them to get their loans approved than it does for white farmers.
My name is Robert Akers.
And where you live?
A place called Farmville, Virginia. I've seen some people that I started for they did, and they're way ahead of me. You understand what I'm saying?
The USDA's Gallegos doesn't deny there are delays.
It has been shown on occasion that some loan applications have taken that long to be finalized. The vast majority of loan applications don't take that long.
The USDA says it can't offer a timeline to pay the claims of farmers who won the lawsuit.
I wish that I could. I can't.
Assistant Secretary for Administration Gallegos says he doesn't want to point fingers, but that the checks are supposed to come from the Justice Department, not the USDA. The Agriculture Department pledges to improve how it's handling the black farmers' payments. Josh Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News at the Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The state of Texas has been at the center of a national controversy regarding the content of school textbooks. Today, religious rights activists are targeting board issues, including teaching global warming, population control, and urban sprawl. Ernesto Aguilar in Houston reports.
Last year, the Republican-dominated State Board of Education rejected a textbook submitted by publisher Jones and Bartlett. The book, Environmental Science, Creating a Sustainable Future, has been used on college campuses for the last 20 years. However, the board took issue with passages dealing with environmental degradation. Board member Don McElroy, in criticizing the book, wrote the author, quote, fundamentally believes our present civilization and its economic system of free enterprise capitalism needs to be replaced. Thus, the entire textbook, in its construct, is flawed by grievous factual error, unquote. The publisher soon withdrew a dozen other books that had been challenged by conservatives and revised others. Now, some publishers have reportedly invited conservative groups to review their books in advance. Ashley McElvain of the Texas Freedom Network, the state organization battling the religious right on textbook issues, says recent controversies have been chilling.
Groups targeted a health textbook to try to censor a photo of a woman carrying a briefcase, which they said undermined traditional family values. They criticized history textbooks as portraying slavery too negatively. And already this year, groups have testified that history books should teach the Christian belief in the resurrection of Christ, teach them that America was founded on biblical principles. Groups have already targeted history textbooks, saying that we should not emphasize such unpatriotic topics as past discrimination and civil rights struggles.
With an annual textbook budget of $570 million, observers say Texas can undoubtedly set textbook adoption standards for the country. McElvain adds the religious right recognizes the potential precedents Texas can set and has invested significant time and money into the textbook campaign.
a number of groups have become more involved as they've seen that the religious right is actually getting an ear within the government and that changes demanded by religious right groups here in Texas are made. And so a number of interest groups have gotten involved. For example, one group this year did a review that they paid professional reviewers to do, and they reviewed 28 textbooks to the tune of $70,000. And this is just one group in one report.
Gary Daniels of the National Coalition Against Censorship, an organization that has documented the right, says the movement to alter textbooks has been honed over the last 30 years and is now a formidable machine with considerable clout.
You have a lot of people who have a certain worldview, and maybe they come at it from a particular issue. Say you have very conservative Christians whose issue is evolution and creationism, and they look at textbooks through that lens. Or you have groups that sexual abstinence is their big issue, and so they look at textbooks through that lens. The environment, capitalism, civil rights, what have you. What you have is then a variety of different organizations and a variety of different individuals who look at textbooks through this lens and say, we don't want this type of information in there. I wouldn't say that there's any kind of vast conspiracy out there, but what you have is, I guess, what amounts to a bunch of little mini-conspiracies.
In November, the State Board of Education will vote to adopt social studies textbooks. McIlvaine says such books have long been the target of conservatives, who she says aim to delete topics they disagree with and instead inject their own ideology.
They, you know, are very well funded, very well organized, and have had a taste of victory over the last couple years and have set their sights now on these social studies textbooks.
This is Ernesto Aguilar for Free Speech Radio News, reporting from Houston.
Angry villagers in Nigeria's Niger Delta region have forced Chevron Texaco to shut down another of its facilities. Villagers who took over the Yuen oil platform, where the oil company produces 26,000 barrels of crude oil a day, are demanding an ecological restoration of their polluted environment. Elsewhere in the Niger Delta, communities say a recent fire disaster at another Chevron Texaco facility has caused environmental problems. They say they've been experiencing acid rain since the fire. Sam Olokoya has the story from the Niger Delta.
The fire disaster occurred at Chevron Texaco's oil terminal at Escravos, where about 400,000 barrels of crude oil is exported daily. The fire was so intense that it caused panic in villages close to the facility. Andrew Ilori is the chief of the nearby Madago community.
Just see smoke, you know that.
Suddenly we saw smoke from afar. It covered everywhere. Then we saw fire. It was then we realized it was from a tank. The heat was affecting everybody. The cloth on our bodies turned black. Everyone was looking for a way to escape. Our wives were crying. People were running all over the place. The heat was increasing.
The thick smoke, which is a product of the burnt crude oil, is now causing acid rain in several communities. Robert Orisajero, a resident of Madago village, showed me some water collected following the acid rain. The water looks like black ink.
See, you can see the colorful water caused by the moisture, that is, the thickness of the smoke mixed with air resulted to this. And if someone inhaled the air, it will surely cause, you know, health hazard. See, the health hazard is not to human alone, it to animals equally.
Residents of the area say domestic animals and birds died after drinking the rainwater. Josephine Ogoba is the women's leader of Abiteye community.
The birds, even the domestic fowls, they drink the water and they died because it was thick smoke and then rainfall again.
Most villages in the area have no pipe-borne water, so they depend on rainwater for cooking and drinking. Andrew Ilori says acid rain has contaminated all their drinking water and the containers used for storing them.
The water we drink turns all containers for storing water black.
That is what is happening here. Only God helped us, otherwise we would have all been dead.
Captain Gedru, a local youth, said those who did not realize that the acid rain is poisonous drank it and subsequently fell ill.
Some people purged and purged, wanted even to die. They rushed them to Chevron. Some Igjaw women even came to Chevron about 3 days ago to attack Chevron. So I want government to actually take control of these things.
Angry villagers say Chevron Texaco officials never bothered to visit them to assess the impact of the fire incident. Andrew Ilori, again.
No good. Everybody now.
We are all still waiting for Chevron till now. People are causing trouble for Chevron. What Chevron is doing is not good.
The Nigerian government has remained silent over the issue. Incidentally, the affected communities are those whose women recently occupied 5 Chevron Texaco installations. The women vacated the installations after the company promised to meet their demands for the provision of social amenities. Observers say growing anger in the communities only weeks after Chevron Texaco reached agreement with them is an indication that the strained relationship between the oil company and its host communities in the area is far from over. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in the Niger Delta, Nigeria.
UN Secretary Kofi Annan says water will be one of the top 5 issues on the agenda when the World Summit on Sustainable Development kicks off in Johannesburg this weekend. Worldwide, 1.2 billion people live without access to safe drinking water, and the situation is worsening. 2 million die every year from waterborne diseases. Most of them are children. Critics of corporate globalization say the current trend of privatizing water systems will only exacerbate the problem, especially in the developing world. Lee Robardis has more.
Participants in the World Water Symposium held in Stockholm the second week in August agreed that water users must be involved in the governance of water resources and that the link between economic growth and water degradation must be severed. But that doesn't mean there are plans to reverse the global trend of privatizing the world's public water systems. In fact, many participants in the Swedish conference, heavily attended by World Bank, IMF, government and corporate officials, treated privatization as inevitable. As delegates packed their bags for the Sustainable Development Summit in South Africa, Dagmara Burbalk of the German Federal Ministry for the Environment seemed cheered by this.
The focus on the role of the private sector participation and development assistance in the water sector is highly relevant for financing the water sector. After many years of debate over whether the private sector should be involved, the debate has shifted to how the private sector should be involved.
99.99% of the people that attend these conferences do not see their children get sick on a regular basis from drinking bad water.
Kevin Danaher of Global Exchange says it's ridiculous for these people to be making the rules. Danaher says typical conference attendees represent forces that want to turn water into a commodity.
On the other side is the life values paradigm, people that are focused on human rights and the environment saying, wait a minute, we're made of water. Water is an absolutely essential human right. It's the one that everything else is secondary to. And to privatize it, what it means is, in a world of increasingly polluted water, thank you corporations, the water is going to become more and more expensive and more poor people will die.
Danaher says in 2000, when Bolivians staged massive protests and threw the water privatizing Bechtel Corporation out, it had little effect on World Bank, IMF, and corporate policies, but it did galvanize a global resistance movement. One place where people are very aware of the water privatization issue is Ghana, a Western African country where in some parts 90% live below the poverty line. Rudolf Amenga Etego of the National Coalition Against the Privatization of Water says Ghana's government is taking bids from five international corporations and plans to choose two to take over Ghana Water, a public utility.
Privatization, if you look at the formula of calculating the profit, it simply means tariffs are going to go up.
The catchphrases here are user fees and cost recovery, referring to the stipulations in World Bank and International Monetary Fund loans that require utility rates to be set high enough to make a profit. But according to Amenga Etego, the people of Ghana face death from water privatization. He says the country is just behind Sudan in instances of guinea worm, a debilitating waterborne disease.
Ghana is already second in Africa, only to Sudan, which is war-torn. So that tells you that when they privatize and the tariffs go up and the poor cannot pay, they go back to pond water, they go back to river water, they go back to dirty water, and guinea worm will increase. Also in Ghana, 70% of reported diseases in Ghana are water-related. Diarrhea, cholera, etc.
Pam Foster with the Halifax Initiative says the World Bank and IMF have been promoting privatization of public utilities for years and have become adept at engineering the debate.
In Ghana, for example, in Bolivia, where it's enormously increased tariffs, the user fees that are charged for cost recovery purposes for water. And what that has done is eliminated the poor's access. So even if they have the hookup, they don't actually have the water. So what they do is they spin the statistics. They say that more households have been hooked up, which is true through privatization, but what happens is they don't actually have it because they're not paying and they get cut off.
And who benefits? Salima Veliani of the Canadian Ecumenical Justice Initiative says it's a wide range of multinational corporations.
It is companies like Enron that benefit because they have investment in hydroelectric projects, which are based on water. You have, as you say, the water bottling companies, and you even have, mining companies, which need a lot of hydroelectricity to run the mines and some of the processing. So it facilitates their usage of water in replacement of the consideration of water as a basic need and therefore, usage by everyday people.
Privatization's advocates say public water systems are inefficient and often riddled with corruption. Rudolf Amenga Etego calls that a dishonest argument. For example, he says, one of the top bidders for Ghana's water system, the French consortium Vivendi, is currently bankrupt and is selling 40% of its worldwide assets to pay its $19 billion debt. Another bidder, Suez Lyonnais, is trying to buy various Enron holdings from the company's Chapter 11 administrators. Kevin Danaher of Global Exchange says corporate interests will pull out all the stops to make sure their agenda is not disrupted at the upcoming Global Development Summit in South Africa. Nonetheless, groups like his and the International Forum on Globalization will try to insert their critique of water privatization into the United Nations process. They'll also use what he terms creative messaging to get the word out. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Lee Robartis.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations KPFA in Berkeley and WBAI in New York and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Aaron Glantz, headlines editor Randy Zimmerman, technical producer Jade Paget-Seekins. We have technical assistance from Kata Mesta and Nell Geiser, web support from Vanessa Tate. Our interns are Rosalind Fay, Susan Chelly, Rich Kim, Fernando Romero, Christopher Martinez, and William Perdomo. I'm Deepa Fernandez.